If somebody is attacked in a dark alley by a maniac who's trying to kill a person on the ground, do bystanders ask, are you ready to give up your arm or leg in order to save your life?
That's Ukrainian ambassador to the United States, Oksana Makarova, explaining why Ukraine won't give up one inch of territory after the Russian invasion.
Putin attacked us. Russian Federation attacked us, unprovoked, unjustified.
I'm Margaret Hoover. This is the Firing Line podcast. I sat down with Ambassador Makarova at the Ukrainian embassy in Washington at this critical juncture, 7 months into the war. As Ukraine's counteroffensive gains momentum, Russian leader Vladimir Putin is mobilizing hundreds of thousands of additional troops and renewing nuclear threats.
When somebody with nuclear weapons publicly threatens others, all countries have to take note.
All as new reports emerge of Russian war crimes.
They specifically take children and deport them to Russia. It's a genocide. It's horrible.
With an increasingly isolationist Republican Party poised to gain power after the midterms, Ambassador Makarova has a warning for Americans.
God forbid if we fall, it will not stop the war. The war will get further, and it will get to the NATO countries. And other countries, including the U.S., will have to send troops to help the NATO allies.
Ambassador Makarova, welcome to Firing Line.
Thank you for having me.
This weekend marked 7 months of war for your country. According to the UN, nearly 6,000 Ukrainian civilians have been killed. But last month, Ukrainian soldiers reclaimed thousands of square miles of territory in the Northeast. I'd like to ask you what the number one message you have for the American people about Ukrainian resolve 7 months into the war.
Well, we said before this stage of the war started, we always said we will not surrender and we will defend our country. I think that does not require proof anymore. Everyone knows we will not surrender. So our message now is that we together have to win. We have to win as collective, civilized part of our planet. And Russian Federation should be defeated for what they've done to us, for what they've done to Georgia, for what they've done to Syria. Because if they are not punished for what they've done, for all of their criminal acts, then our planet is not a safe place to live for any of us, especially for those who are peaceful and do not attack anyone.
This week, Putin held referendums in four occupied regions in eastern and southern Ukraine, paving the way to annex territory even larger than the size of Portugal. Now, Russian soldiers have been going door to door, armed with machine guns, collecting ballots at gunpoint. President Biden and many Western leaders are dismissing these votes as sham elections. What message do you have for Ukrainians living in occupied territories right now?
I wouldn't even call it referendums, because we saw what Russian war criminals are doing on the occupied territories. We've seen enormous atrocities in Bucha. We've seen horrible mass graves with people who were tortured before they were killed in Kharkiv Oblast. We can only guess what we will see when we liberate Mariupol and other places. But what we know for sure is that everyone under this occupation, regardless of whether it's 32 days like my hometown was, or months like we see now in some other places, all people want to be back. All people want to live in Ukraine. All people are doing everything possible and sometimes impossible just to survive and wait for our soldiers to come and liberate them. So this referendum or elections or whatever they want to call it, this sham events, were only held in, you know, Putin's minds and in the minds of people who staged it. But nobody will ever recognize it. That's not how you conduct any democratic processes, not under the gunfire. And frankly, I don't even know why they are even trying to do it, because the whole world sees everything that happens on our territory exactly how it happens. Everyone knows that it was Russia that attacked us, a large nuclear country that attacked peaceful, small, non-nuclear country, actually one of the very few countries that got rid of the nuclear arsenal, the third largest nuclear arsenal voluntarily.
I've noticed that every single time you or your president, President Zelensky, are interviewed, you are asked a version of the question, would Ukraine cede some territory to Russia in order to end the war? And every time, you have both said no. What is the effect of the cumulative series of questions, the same question over and over, on you and your people?
It's a very profound question, which we have to analyze the question more than actually the answer. I think through the past 30 years, and if we look back 100 years, the West has seen our region through the eyes of Russian propaganda in a number of things. I mean, Russians altered and tried to steal our history. It was a surprise for some people here, and I'm not talking about politicians or government, but I'm talking about ordinary people, that Ukraine had independence in 1918, that Ukraine has a deep, rich history and was independent way long before Russia even existed as a separate country. So I think, you know, there were a number of experts who built their careers here in the United States or elsewhere on studying the Soviet Union, studying the, you know, this secret Russian soul or whatever it is. And they missed a simple fact that whether it's called Russian Federation or Soviet Union or Russian Empire before that, they have always been trying to occupy the countries around them. They are keeping some of the countries now which are part of Russian Federation but who do not have any freedoms inside. So when people ask us this question, are we ready to cede any territories to return to peace, I think they're asking a question about the options which never existed, doesn't exist, and will not exist. Because for us to be, to live free within our internationally recognized borders, for us to live as Ukrainians, we have to defend ourselves. And ceding territories or appeasing aggressor will never get to peace. It will embolden Russian Federation or any other aggressor to do even worse things to us. But ultimately, we also have to understand that this war that Putin wages on us, Russian Federation wages on Ukraine, is much bigger than Ukraine.
So you think even the question represents decades of thinking through the prism of what's important for Russia rather than for the autonomy?
Exactly. So just imagine the situation. Putin attacked us. Russian Federation attacked us, unprovoked, unjustified. We are defending our homes and we are asked to do something. If somebody is attacked in a dark alley by a maniac who's trying to kill a person on the ground, do bystanders ask, are you ready to give up your arm or leg in order to save your life? No, they call the police. They try to do something. They stop and put in prison that person. So I think, you know, this is what we all collectively should ask ourselves. What Russian Federation has to do in order to return peace?
One of the concerns now is that Putin will treat the annexed land as Russian territory, which he's vowed to defend using all means at his disposal. And last week, Putin renewed his nuclear threat, saying, quote, it is not a bluff. And then after those remarks, President Zelensky said that Putin's nuclear threats now could be a reality. Is this nuclear blackmail?
We have seen this blackmail from Russian Federation on a number of issues. If you count numerous red lines that Putin was drawing for the for Ukraine and collective West, remember he was Finland and Sweden accession into NATO was a red line. Ukrainians using the Western weapons and equipment was a red line. Us retaking the territories back was a red line. He actually is a part of nuclear blackmail already because they control illegally one of the largest European nuclear stations in Ukraine for the past couple of months. So we are trying, again, doing everything possible and impossible together with the association and the agency in order to prevent Russians to do something, to shell at the nuclear station and to cause a nuclear accident already that could be tragic, not only for Ukraine, but for the region. Again, it's the station that is 6 times larger than Chernobyl. And we all remember what was the effect of a nuclear event in Chernobyl during the Soviet times. So, of course, we cannot take it lightly when somebody with a nuclear weapons publicly threatens others. All countries have to take a note and act and strengthen the sanctions and together be, you know, build a response based on strength.
That response based on strength. I mean, it's, you're right. It's not just a nuclear arsenal. It's the world's largest nuclear arsenal that Russia has. And the U.S. has warned that, quote, catastrophic consequences would result if Putin resorted to nuclear escalation. But the U.S. has been very vague about what kind of consequences would result. What are you hearing from your colleagues and the diplomatic community, particularly in the U.S., about what a possible U.S. response would look like?
Well, this is a very sensitive issue, and I will not try to interpret, what the U.S. would do. But I think we have heard a very strong message from President Biden in his very short phrase when he said, don't, don't, don't. And for us, I know that regardless of what Russian Federation is trying to do to us, whether they mobilize people, whether they publicly try to scare us with anything, there is only one choice for us, to defend our country. So we have to stay the course. More weapons, more sanctions, more support to Ukraine. And if we together, as United Nations, and I actually was very pleased during this recent General Assembly to see that it's not only our usual friends, not only the European Union, Great Britain, United States as the strategic friend number one, Japan, other countries, but we have heard concerns from many countries which, were not as straightforward before, but the issue of sovereignty, territorial integrity, the issue of nuclear safety is a critical issue for all the countries, unless, of course, you are a pariah and in the club of, North Korea and Iran, and you're ready to send drones to attack a peaceful nation to another war criminal. So I think, every threat and every decision that Russian Federation and Putin is making now, including the mobilization, is actually opening eyes of everyone for his true intention. So he and his people can say as much as they want that they're ready for the talks, but people are looking at deeds. If you're ready for the peace, you don't mobilize 300,000 or even more people in order to attack more.
You just said that you were surprised and delighted by the United Nations General Assembly because there were countries that weren't the usual suspects. They're supporting Ukraine. Who are some of them?
Well, a number of countries. I wouldn't name some of them, but we actually didn't hear from anyone but, four countries that usually vote together with Russia. We didn't hear from anyone words of support to Russia. We didn't hear from any country that they are okay with a large country violating sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine.
So if there were a nuclear attack, what should the U.S. response be?
Look, I think we have to do, all of us, everything possible to prevent it. And to prevent it means to support Ukraine more and to isolate Russia more. And I think Russian Federation miscalculated before the start of this phase of the war. They miscalculated the Ukrainian resolve and our readiness to defend our country. They also miscalculated how united the West will be in supporting us.
Last week, Vladimir Putin said he was mobilizing up to 300,000 reservists. That's roughly double the number of Russian troops at the beginning of the invasion. Does your country, Ukraine, have enough troops and resources to fight off 300,000 more Russian soldiers?
We will fight as long as it's necessary. And of course, it's our chief commander, President Zelensky. It's our commander, Zaluzhny. It's our brave armed forces. But it's all 40 million of Ukrainians who are fighting. Believe it or not, we still have lines in the conscription posts of people who want to go and fight for our country. So, of course, we are concerned about this mobilization.
What does that tell you about his strength, his position of strength that he needs to
call? He had problems with troops for a long time now. First of all, they've lost more than 50,000 people in Ukraine already, which means that there is times that, you know, people who are wounded, and it's a big loss for the Russian army. Second, we are defending our homes, our loved ones. We are very motivated. We do not see that motivation in the Russian troops. What are they there doing? Attacking an independent nation, killing civilians, torturing women and children. This is not the motivation that drives armies to actually fight as our army fights. And third, also, clearly, with the footages that we see from Russia, with, again, all the Russians either trying to flee the country or trying to escape this mobilization, shows that it's one thing to support the war, watching through the television of what's going on, but it's a totally different thing when you have to go and do it yourself. So it's definitely not a sign of strength that he had to announce this mobilization and try to get more people. Now, I don't want to be overconfident. 300,000 people is a lot of people. And as motivated as we are, we will require additional support in weapons in order to deal with it. And that's why the continuation of support from the U.S., from the Rammstein group, from other friends and allies is critical, that it has to continue. And we together also have to stay the course.
So the mobilization itself, I want to talk about how that's landed on the Russian public, because thousands of Russians have taken to the streets protesting this mobilization. Thousands of Russians protesting the mobilization have been detained by Putin's government. Radio Free Europe, Radio Liberty, has spoken to Russians on both sides of this issue, and they have a video which has gone viral in Russia with Russians talking about how they feel about the mobilization. Do you have a message for Russian civilians who are risking their freedom by speaking out against the war?
Those who speak against the war since the beginning of this war and since the beginning of the war 8 years ago, I can only tell them that we appreciate it and we thank them. But unfortunately, the number of those Russians is so small, which was a big disappointment, I have to say, because we have lived in the same Soviet prison for a long time. And we have seen how a number of nations who were freed from this prison and who got independence managed to actually start in building societies to deliver for their people, to take care of their people. Whereas Russia never went through this de-imperialization, if I may call it, process. It was so sad to see how many Russian people supported the war, how many Russian people knowing the truth, seeing the truth, how many people who were organized for their son to call their parents of the prisoners of war that we had during this almost 7 months, and that didn't change their position. So again, as much as we are grateful for those who protest, I don't even know whether I still hope that the Russian society can wake up. Well, and they should do it not to help us. They should do it for themselves.
And yet, many Russian men are now attempting to flee Russia. They're attempting to leave the country to escape conscription. European officials, in fact, are debating whether or not to offer safe haven to Russians who are leaving Russia. German and French officials have indicated an interest in granting asylum to people fleeing. The Baltic states, Finland, and Poland have closed their doors to Russian tourists. What is Ukraine's position on how EU nations should respond to this?
Our president has been very clear about it, that there should be a visa ban for every Russians, for all the Russians. If they support the war, if they support the aggression, if they support attack against a European country and European values, they should not have the right to enjoy all the European freedoms and benefits while they're not ready to do it back home.
Even if they're escaping a war that they don't support.
But they're not escaping the war. There is no war in Russia. They are not being bombed. There is no threat to their children. There is no threat to their families.
Escaping a conscription in order to serve in the war.
They were okay with it for the past 7 months. They were okay when Ukrainian children were bombed and killed. They were okay when our women and men were raped and tortured. Now, I would be very careful for some of the countries who would accept a large number of Russians who are escaping with disease signs on their T-shirts.
So the Ukrainian position is not to support a French or a German program to take in Russians fleeing conscription.
I just don't see what good will it do for either these countries or Russia, for that matter.
The Ukrainian government has opened a hotline, the I Want to Live hotline, where Russian soldiers can call and surrender. And President Zelensky has promised not to return those who surrender to Russia. How many calls has the hotline received?
I don't have the information yet, but at the beginning of the war, when we started the hotlines for the mothers to call and mothers or family members to see whether their sons or loved ones are in Ukrainian territory, it became very popular in Russia, because in the situation when there was total lack of information and when the Russian military officials were lying simply, that there were no Russian soldiers on our territory, that they were on training somewhere, people were looking for this information. Similarly, when we started the Telegram channels to put out information and documents, the subscription there grew rapidly. So again, as our president said, Ukraine has shown during the seven months that we are very responsible. We are treating the prisoners with, you know, not only according to all the conventions, but they're fed, they're treated, they're, you know, we are different. We are not executing people. We are not torturing them. We are not killing them. And right now, whoever doesn't want to participate in this criminal war should surrender.
A United Nations-backed commission concluded last week that war crimes have been committed in Ukraine. And we've learned about torture, mass graves in Bucha, Izium. But there are two specific kinds of atrocities that I'd like to talk to you about specifically. The first is called filtration. According to Human Rights Watch, Yale University Humanitarian Research Lab, and the UN, Ukrainians in occupied territories have suffered numerous human rights violations, including being sent to internment camps. What can you tell this American audience about the practice of filtration?
This is the word that I thought we would only read in books about the World War II and about what Nazi did. When people are stripped, searched, interrogated, tortured, in order to find out whether they support Ukraine or not. People who are Ukrainians, people who are on the Ukrainian soil, people who were separated from their children, and we have even cases when the children were sent to Ukraine with some other people and mother was detained. This is despicable war crime. This is what so many Ukrainians have to go through. This is what all the liberated Ukrainians are describing in gruesome details. And we are positive that regardless of how much time it will take, there will be justice. And all responsible for this will be brought to justice.
I want to talk about that justice in a second, but I want to focus on the second atrocity, which is so horrifying. And
sure.
The Assistant UN Secretary General for Human Rights says there are, quote, credible allegations of forced transfers of unaccompanied children to Russian-occupied territory and to Russia. Now, forcibly transferring children is one of the specific definitions of genocide according to the Genocide Convention. Can you tell us exactly what is happening? How many children? Where are they being sent? What is being done to get them back to their families?
This is one of the most difficult questions which our First Lady when she was here with the visit to Washington, D.C., and when she was now with the delegation to the UN, is raising everywhere, because it's a kidnapping of Ukrainian children, people who were in orphanages, people who were in foster care, but also people who were on the territories which were occupied, whose parents were either killed or they don't know where they are. I mean, it's a war situation. They specifically take children and deport them to Russia. They even change the local legislation in order to make easier the adoption process. Mm-hmm. And the most difficult part of it is that we know how many children we cannot account for. We don't know, because it's all on either occupied territories or in Russia, where we cannot get any information from, clearly. I mean, they're hiding it from us. But we see their statements of the State Duma representatives who actually call for it, who specifically say that Ukrainian children should be even like placed in some kind of institution so they can be de-Ukrainianized. I mean, it's a genocide. It's horrible. It's, you know, for anyone who's normal, this is not normal. This is something that should not only be a question of bringing people to justice, but, you know, who are these people who do this?
One of the things Americans have looked at is how the United States' role during World War II impacted the Nazi genocide of the Jews. And we've taken some time to reflect on what we could have done differently at the time. Are there parallels or lessons that the United States and the West should be awakened to against the current situation that you call a genocide in Ukraine?
Well, I think now I can thank the U.S. for the leadership, because all these issues of justice, and we just recently had the delegation of the General Prosecutor of Ukraine to Washington, D.C., and there are a number of groups that we have together with the U.S., together with the Attorney General, together with Department, the DOJ, but also other agencies and Department of State working specifically on that. So U.S. is helping us with documenting the evidence. U.S. is helping us in preparing the cases, not only internally, but also with the international organizations. We have Ambassador Beth Wanskak, who's really actively engages in this, you know, crimes against humanity, I would even. I know that there are legal terms which lawyers usually use or not use based on evidence. But as a Ukrainian and Ukrainian ambassador, when I see genocide and when I see crimes against humanities, whether we already have all the base or not, I know what it is. So I think right now it's the question, it's not even a question whether we are on the same page there. It's a question, what can we do together in order to have the justice faster? And we are working very actively with the United States. So there I can only thank, you know, President Biden, everyone in the administration, Congress, for continuous not only attention to these issues, but allocating funds, allocating people, and putting together institutional capacity to deal with it.
So how will Russia be held accountable for this genocide?
Well, ultimately, we believe the crime of this magnitude deserves a separate tribunal. So right now we're working, we have criminal investigation and criminal prosecution in Ukraine. We have more than 10 countries that opened their own criminal cases when they have jurisdiction. And we're sharing all the evidence and all the information, and we encourage other countries to also start the criminal prosecution of Russian Federation and Russian war criminals. We have open cases in the international courts, the Court of Human Rights and Criminal Court, mm-hmm. and their teams are on the ground also evaluating evidence. So we're trying to ensure that there is no place on our planet where these people could hide from the justice. But ultimately, you know, a crimes of this proportion will call for its own tribunal, because it's very important to prosecute Russian Federation for what they really did. Not only the individual soldiers on the ground, not only the commanders, not only the oligarchs and the financiers who helped to do these crimes because they financed this war, but also collectively, the country that actually planned, conducted, and conducted the genocide.
President Zelensky recently called Russian forces terrorists. He's urging the United States to designate Russia as a state sponsor of terrorism. And President Biden has resisted this so far. The National Security Advisor, Jake Sullivan, has said that the Biden administration already has imposed far stiffer sanctions on Russia than it has against nations that have been designated state sponsors of terror. Why is getting that designation from the White House so important?
Well, first, it's very important to call Russia what they really are. Russia is aggressor and Russia is a terrorist state. In fact, Russian Federation is probably the largest terrorist organization that operates now on our planet. Now, the closest existing designation to that is the designation of a country sponsor of terrorists. And that includes a lot of sanctions and a lot of limitations. And this is what the goal is, to isolate Russia until they change their behavior. Now, whether it's that designation or a new designation, whatever it is that can be made quickly and isolate Russia completely, this is what the goal is. That's why President Zelensky and all of us are trying on a daily basis to work with our partners here to convince that this is time to do this designation. This is time to completely cut them from all of their resources and completely isolate them so that they realize that they have to stop.
Is there a next round of sanctions that you would like to see?
Absolutely. There is still a lot we can do together. First, the Russian financial system. Yes, a number of large banks have been sanctioned, both by the United States and by European Union, and some of them have been de-swifted. But as we see in Russia, there is no such thing as private banking or private commercial sector. Every time one bank is sanctioned, some other banks pick up their activities in financing the war or financing the military. So we believe all Russian banks, all 330, should be sanctioned. All of them should be cut off from the international system. If they would like to finance this war, they should only do it inside Russia. They should not be able to participate in the global financial markets. Similarly with other Russian companies and commercial entities and Russian oligarchs. And I think we have achieved a lot there together with our colleagues, especially in the United States, because the U.S. is leading the global effort in those sanctions. Now, we believe that, the restrictions on oil and gas and all others, the U.S. has been in the leading role there. We realize how reliant European and other markets are on the Russian oil, and therefore, it's great to see that the U.S. is working with all the partners to come up with some creative ideas, like the price cap for oil. But ultimately, I think it's important for all of us to understand that any reliance on Russia, on anything, is a weakness and ultimately a risk for any normal country. So we have to not only isolate and sanction Russia, but think how we will replace them in all the supply chains, how we can reorient and work together better in order to address these challenges. Therefore, this is one of the reasons why everyone have to help us to win faster, because Ukraine is a key to a number of challenges like this. In agri-food, Ukraine, it's not just a great name that we are the breadbasket of Europe. We have seen after Russia stopped all the grain and other exports from Ukraine, how that affected so many countries around the world. And now when we were able, with the participation of the UN Secretary General and others, to have this very limited grain deal, but to get the food out, and we were able even to donate some of the grain to Ethiopia and Somalia from Ukraine, We saw that so many countries rely upon us. We can produce more, we can grow more, we can feed the world. Similar with energy. While Russia is using the gas as the, again, a blackmail tool, Ukraine can produce much more, and we already export electricity. We can do more if we can get Russians out from our nuclear station. If we can win this war, then we can produce more. So, you know, I think we all have to shift the way we look at the region. And of course, now the focus, it's existential for us to win. And the focus is how do we win? But the next stage is how do we not only rebuild Ukraine better, but how Ukraine can be an answer to so many global challenges.
You're calling for the world to continue to support Ukraine. You've said it's going to be much cheaper and much better for the democratic world to win this war while it is still in Ukraine. Make the case to Americans why it is in their best interest to win in Ukraine. And I want to place that against the backdrop of the 2022 elections. Because there is some speculation that Republicans might sweep the House and the Senate, and there is an isolationist trend in the Republican Party that is less interested in being involved in foreign wars. So make the case for why it is in Americans' best interest for Ukraine to win.
Let me state three reasons why. First, because it's the right thing to do. Because we believe in the same values, we have the same principles, we believe in freedom and independence. This is what this country is built on, and this is what we are fighting for. So I think, you know, this fight is in the heart of every American. Second, because, you know, this is a David against Goliath fight. So it's about big injustice that we are fighting against, and we can win. The second part is on this, why is it cheaper? President Putin and all of the people around him numerous times said what their goals are. They are restoring the Soviet Union. It's not only about us. They are threatening Poland, they are threatening Baltic states, they are threatening other countries in Europe. So, God forbid, if we fall, it will not stop the war. The war will get further, and it will get to the NATO countries, and it will trigger Article 5. So that's what I mean when I say it's going to be more expensive, and other countries, including the US, will have to send troops to help the NATO allies. We don't need troops. We need financial and security support, and we will do this job ourselves. And third, what I a little bit said earlier, is that Ukraine on the crossroads of Europe and Asia, with all the natural resources, with the IT, you know, personnel, with engineering, we can be the answer to so many challenges that we face now globally, from food to energy to future development, that if we win together, or I should say when we win together, we can do so many great things together. And I think, you know, there is a win-win situation for the US and Ukraine from this future reconstruction, but also working together as strategic friends to make our planet a safer place.
You just referenced Putin's ambitions and how they won't stop with Ukraine. Putin has compared his quest to win back the so-called Russian lands of Peter the Great. In 1990, as the final collapse of the Soviet Union was imminent, Russian scholar Richard Pipes joined the original host of this program, William F. Buckley, Jr.
I don't think you could go back to the old ideology, but you could inflame Russian nationalism. In its chauvinistic forms.
And what ways would it likely express itself?
Well, that
would it become a nuclear terror again?
Well, we Russians are a great nation. We are a supreme nation. And we will not let go of of the Ukraine. We will not let go of the other republics. And we ought to be a world power. And we ought not to give up Eastern Europe. There was a mistake, and if possible, we should recover Eastern Europe.
I mean, that even that is conceivable.
Well, it's conceivable, so nothing has changed. So all you have to do is just change the labels and you're back in business.
That last bit, just change the labels and you're back in business. So what does the world need to understand about Putin's mindset?
Just believe what he says and act upon it. In his sham articles, in his public statement before this phase of the war, everything he said, from the famous notion that the breakup of the Soviet Union has been the biggest tragedy, it's all out there. Russian Federation never pretended that they are democratic, peaceful nation that want to just focus on how to develop their own country for their own people. They never cared about how to deliver to their people. They always have been pretty clear about their imperialistic ambitions. So we have to believe it, take it into account, and act. Isolate, sanction, and work together to show that we together as democracies can also not only deliver to our people, but defend ourselves.
Ambassador Markarova, thank you for your time and thank you for joining me on Firing Line.
Thank you.